Soloveitchik next. The Soloveitchik of Yosef Dov Soloveitchik of Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. It's a little bit of a daunting personality. Both, again, really everyone should be daunting. Everyone of these Gedolei Torah should be daunting to try to capture the depth and perspective of them. But the Soloveitchik is a little bit more because I know how little I know about him, plus everyone else where I just don't even know him. Nonetheless, I think we'll try our best to capture as best as we can, as much as we can, as possibly can, about who he is, etc., etc. He was born in 1903 and died in 1993, lived 90 years. He was educated as a young boy in a Chabad cheder, and actually has a major important influence on his life. He tells stories, he writes about it, he found influence. Chabad Malamdin had at a younger age. He was most prominently educated by his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. We'll talk about the family in a little bit. They had a tremendously important, significant religious dynasty. But his major Gemara Rebbe was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, his father. He had a college education in Berlin at age 22. He majored in philosophy. There he developed a relationship with Chaim Heller. He developed a friendship with the Lubavitch Rebbe. There were other people there, Nechama Leibowitz, not sure their actual relationship, they had it all. But she was also at the University of Berlin at the time. In 1931, he got his doctorate for a dissertation on Hermann Cohen's epistemology and metaphysics. In 1932, he got married and he came to the United States to teach. In 1941, he began teaching in Yeshiva University. In terms of his family, the family name Soloveitchik may be the biggest rabbinic dynasty ever. Just the amount of people, you know, and Gedolei Torah that came out, and the influence they had in the world of learning, the world of brisk, the brisker lamdanim, the brisker derech, the way that people learn, etc., etc. We'll talk about it a little bit. His great grandfather, I guess, and you could even start earlier than that, but we'll start with the Soloveitchik family. The other family, in other words, had many people who are related to him, but not direct ben achar ben. We'll start with his great, and their tremendous, you know, accomplishments in learning are also nothing to miss out. But at some point in time, you gotta cut it short and keep it to what we have. His great grandfather, who has the exact same name as he does, Rav Yosef Dov Halevi, he was named after his great grandfather. He wrote a commentary on Chumash called the Beis Halevi. He has a commentary on the Gemara called the Beis Halevi. He was called the Beis Halevi. He was a huge lamdan. He was a Rosh Shiva of a Lushan for some time. There was actually a fight between him and the Netziv. He ended up leaving. Yet they ended up having they became related a little bit later on when Rav Chaim married the Netziv's granddaughter. In other words, even though they got into a fight, the Beis Halevi and the Netziv, they were actually kind of mechutanim. One's son married the other Netziv's granddaughter. In any event, which also makes the Netziv related to the Rav as well. No, that sounds like a Chassidus people who did get along. This is a Litvish people who didn't get along. I don't know. In any event, the Beis Halevi had a son, or more than one, maybe, I don't know, but the famous son is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is also known as Rav Chaim Brisker. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik maybe is one of the most influential people on learning Gemara since Rabbeinu Tam. Almost single-handedly systematized and revolutionized the style of learning. It's called the Brisker Derech Halimud, the Brisker style of learning. It definitely follows after Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. There's a lot of classifying, a lot of categorizing, a lot of defining, a lot of asking what's behind the machlokas. No longer are we trying to prove one sheet to right and the other sheet to wrong. No longer are we just focusing on one opinion, ignoring the other ones. But Rav Chaim is safe, if not mistaken, every time except for once. Answers both sheetas. He explains the Rambam sheeta, explains the Raavad sheeta. And at the end of the day, he has an explanation for both. He's not just interested in asking a question on one and answering. He's interested in presenting both sides of the equation. What? Yeah. This is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had the Rav's, I guess, maternal grandfather is Rav Elia Feinstein, who was a very chashuv Talmid Chacham in his own right. It's Rav Moshe Feinstein, I think his great uncle or something like that. And the Feinstein family was also a very prestigious, well-respected family. His uncle was the Brisker Rav, Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav Yitzchak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik. They called him the Griz, which stood for Gon Rav Yitzchak Zev. They also called him the Brisker Rav. They also called him Rav Elvel Soloveitchik, called him the same people, same person. Also one of the major Gedolim of the previous generation, maybe two generations ago. His father was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, was also a very, very Chashuv Talmid Chacham, a rav of shul, just a real first class lamdan. His mother was Hesha Feinstein Salvechik, who was the Elie Revelli Feinstein's daughter, and she was also from a very prestigious family, a well-educated lady, etc., etc. His wife, just while we're building the family's wife's name was Tanya. She passed away, I think, in 1967, before the war, around that point in time. I remember I was reading in one of the letters, so they asked the Rav, why don't you make Aliyah in 67? Just the way he talks about how his heart was ripped out when his wife had passed away. She was the apple of her life, and just, you literally felt the pain that he was going through in 67 when he lost his wife. The truth is, he lost three people that year. He lost his mother, his brother, and his wife in a 3-month span, which is absolutely very, very sad. A Rebbe who once went to the Rav to go visit him during Shivan, at this point in time, he said to him, Rebbe, you need a few days off. Do you want to stop coming in? Maybe stop giving shir. He says, I lost three of my closest relatives. Do you want me to lose the Kaddish Baruch Hu too? We'll talk about that in a little bit, how the Rav viewed learning as a connection to our Kaddish Baruch Hu, connection to the Sar, etc., etc. In any event, his brother was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. He had another brother named Dr. Shmuel Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was also very chashuv talmid chacham. He opened the yeshiva of Brisk in Chicago. Eventually moved to YU when the Rav passed away. He has a few sisters. One of them's name is Shulamit Soloveitchik Meiselman. She married Rav Moshe Meiselman, who became the Rosh Yeshiva of Paris Moshe, and named the yeshiva after Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav's father. There was another one named Annie Soloveitchik, who married a man named Mr. Gerber, became Annie Gerber. His children, he has a son named Chaim Soloveitchik, who's named after his own grandfather. They call him Dr. Grach. He has another one who's named Atara Soloveitchik, who married Rabbi Yitzhak Twersky from Boston, who was the Talmud Rebbe, as well as the head of Judaic studies in all of Harvard. They actually have three children. One of them, is Moshe Twersky, who teaches in Taras Moshe. One of them is Rav Meir Twersky, who teaches in YU. And one of them, I forgot her name, but she married Rabbi Rosenblatt from Riverdale. In any event, then they have Dr. Tova Soloveitchik, who married Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who's Rosh Yeshiva in Gush. And that's the Rav's other son-in-law. Lichtenstein is one of the Gedolei Dor. Again, if I told you the other half of the family, you'd be even more blown away. It really is a very, very prestigious family, a very Rabbanisha family, and all the way down the Twersky's children and the Lichtenstein children, you know, and certainly other you know, ancestors. Yeah. Correct. Soloveitchik. She's a Varen, I think she's from Varen Soloveitchik's daughter. And yeah, it could be this is the biggest rabbinic family in all of world history. His name. Yeah. In terms of learning, so it's a continuation of the Brisker Derech we mentioned earlier on. There's a lot of classifying, categorizing, defining it. No longer leaves things unvague, is a clear, crisp definition of what the halachic terminology is. In terms of his shir and the style of shir, the Rav was known to start fresh every single time, meaning if he, just because he said 7 years ago, he learned Bava Metzia last time, the following Svara, now he's looking at it from a brand new perspective. He's looking at the Rambam afresh, anew, he's looking at things brand new. And even he would contradict himself what he said 7 years ago, and so he'd be like, hey, but you said 7 years ago the following thing, and he wouldn't care. I'm talking about what I'm saying now, don't worry about what I was saying 7 years ago. I'm learning the sugya new. He would yell at people for quoting what he said in the past. There was a lot of tension and fear in the yeshiva, in his shir. I'll tell you two quick stories. One story is a bunch of MTA boys who were in 12th grade who wanted to join the shir in YU. And they wanted to sneak in, they wanted to go, and eventually they worked it out that they can go. And Soloveitchik didn't want such a big shir. He wanted to really work with the best boys, not just have it open to anyone who's nice you want to come, but go to a shir, it's appropriate for you. And he ripped into these boys. So he had him read the Gemara the first day, and he asked questions, and it just totally tore him to shreds. And the boys had no idea what to do. So they called up the rabbis and said, please, tell your husband to make it easy on us. He walks in the next day, cowards! You know, the Rav Shir, it was, and he, outside of Shir, he was a very sweet man, but inside Shir was very chariot. There's a story, I've heard the story, where Rebbein was Rebbe, he's actually in Arabian, a very chashuv talmid chacham, who was sitting in the Shir. And he has a little bit of a stutter, and the Rav says, what is your name? He starts shaking. I'm not asking you a tough question. What is your name? And two or three times, and eventually, somehow whispers, I think it was like loud, it's not a Mashkiach of Wayu, Ezra. And he whispers, and he says, oh, my name is Ezra. It's like a tremendous, you know, the Rav, he he would rip into if he didn't like what you had to say. He had no mercy on you. This is an intellectual environment where we, you know, we're ruthless and try best to develop, specifically in the 30s and 40s, when the Rav was much more harif and younger. In the 50s and 60s, and certainly the 70s and 80s, was a lot more mellow, a lot more chilled out. He was older and weaker. He only gave twice a week later on. But they say even the Rav was in an older age. He didn't have the strength to keep his eyes open. He could barely walk into the shiur. But once he got into a kasha, he saw the Torah start, going through his body. And the blood started bubbling. He, developed the same, the fire in his eyes and the tremendous emotion and passion he had even as a younger boy. The Rav was first and foremost a Lamdin, first and foremost a halachically oriented individual. He was about a halachic man. Beyond that, he was just a Rosh Hashiva in the classical sense, sugyas and gemaras, and trying to work out a pshat in a Rambam and a steer in a Rambam and difficult words in a Rambam and a machlokas Rashi Tosfos. He used to love dealing with the machlokas, the Balamar and the Melchamis. That would really be very challenging for him. And as broad-minded and as sophisticated and as profound and as well-rounded as the Rav was, it'd be misleading to tell you anything that he was, and his heart and his kishkas, he was a real classic Rosh Hashiva. However, beyond that, he was tremendous in every other area. And if he would have only written and spoken and developed thought in these other areas, he'd be a profound philosopher and a profound, Talmud Chacham in the world of Tanakh, etc., etc. He learned Tanakh, all these great ideas. There's a book that just came out by Rabbi Avishai David called Darash Darash Yosef, and a lot of the Rav's drushes. Some of them are more famous, some are less famous. He has the famous idea of Adam 1 and Adam 2, where he really deals with Pshat and Chumash and the ideas of it. Basically, there's two different presentations of creation. Perek Aleph and Bereishis, as well as the first thing took on Perek Bet, which is Adam 1, the way Adam is presented in first Perek, and then Adam 2 is the way it's presented in Perek Bet. And there are two different presentations of specifically Adam Harishon as well as man in general. One is more philosophical, asking questions of why, and one is much more practical, asking questions of how. And one is more lonely than the other. And actually, he wrote about it in a 125-page book called The Lonely Man of Faith. In addition to The Lonely Man of Faith, he wrote a book called Halachic Man and Halachic Mind. He had, positions in Hashkafa and in politics. And although he had positions, what the Talmidim say, what I've heard from the Talmidim is that much better that you develop your own thought than me tell you my thought. And therefore, in Shir, he did nothing but learning. He didn't give over Hashkaf. He didn't give over anything but learning. Anything but Gemara. But outside, there was definitely, he wrote and he thought and etc., etc. He didn't publish very much. It's classic in the Soloveitchik family not to publish too much. They wanted everything he published to be perfect. He published a few things in English. However, when he passed away, all of his Talmidim, many of his Talmidim, I should say, published all sorts of works on Masechtas, on this Gemara, and that Gemara. Rabbi Reichman has a few Sfarim on this, and other people have stuff on that, and people have, Rav Michal Shurkin has on the Moedim, and Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Yarakan have on Sefer Torah, and on Yom Kippurim, and on Tefillin, and stuff like that. There's all sorts of Sfarim coming out with the Rav's Torah, after he passed away. Tremendous passion for Torah. The Rav used to tell, what it's like when he was learning. He remembers as a young boy, he didn't have many friends. His only good friend was the Rambam. He remembers at his father's table, the father would sit down and open up a Rambam and start asking kashas. And everyone around the table would start asking kashas. And the Rav felt the pain the Rambam would as a young boy. It's difficult to imagine, right? He writes, the pain I felt as my friend the Rambam was being attacked and being attacked and being attacked. And there were 10, 15 kashas on the Rambam, and slowly but surely my father would start defending the Rambam and developing a theory and developing an idea and answering question after question after question. Until finally, my best friend the Rambam, says the Rav, stood strong and defended himself against all of his attackers. So that's what happened mostly. My father gives share. Once in a while, my father would just put his hands down in his head and say, Rabosa, I'm sorry, the Shver Rambam, the difficult Rambam. And the Rav says, as a young boy, I'd run into my mother's arms crying, Abba couldn't defend the Rambam, Abba couldn't defend the Rambam, who's going to defend the Rambam? And she said, Yosef, Beryl used to call him, Yosef, so one day you'll grow up and maybe you'll be able to defend the Rambam. And there's like the stories he grew up, the life he grew up with. He goes, now I'm a little bit older. I have a different perspective. Because I walk in, I sit down and learn, I read the Gemara, and all of a sudden Rashi's to my right, and he starts explaining the Gemara, and Tosa starts attacking him on the left. And then I want to look for the Psak, I look at the Rambam, and the Rabbi's at the end of the table attacking the Rambam. And I open up the Shulchan Aruch, and the Shach is speaking, and the Taz is asking on him, and it's my job to kind of defend them and explain that each of them is going on. At the end of the day, they all walk away happy. They all smile and give me a hug. And I feel like I've reconnected with a lot more friends than just the Rambam. My Rambam was my childhood friend. Now I have the Rambam as well as other friends. And I connect to the Chachmei HaMesorah. It's such a beautiful, detailed, descriptive way. Prolific, maybe even. The way he connects to the Chachmei HaMesorah. It's unique. You see a tremendous love of Torah. Tremendous appreciation of where he stands in the Chachmei HaMesorah. Out of Shir, the Rav was a warm, friendly person. The community in Boston, where his shul was, and the school Maimonides he started was, really felt that way. Remember I heard from Moshe looking to the story of the Rav, maybe wearing a towel, saying, Mutulach, Mutulach. He's like, stop taking upon all these chumas, all these nadarim, whatever the situation was. He was the role of the Rav as well. And he would speak about the closeness he had to his Talmidim, although Talmidim very often didn't feel as close to him as he did to them. But Talmidim did not necessarily feel that he had a warm relationship with them. He felt very much connected to them. They all felt he was mistaken. The Rav had a unique, maybe it could just be, he learned with them together. He learned Torah with them. They felt that was a good enough, he felt that was a good enough way of connecting. It could be they felt interpersonally they didn't get much attention from him. I remember I had one of our band was Binyamin Tabori, I think he used to say that printed in one's farm as well, but the Rav's father never kissed him, never kissed the Rav. Once, I think the Rav was off to America or something like that, and the Rav's father was kind of said goodbye. And the Rav said, she was off for either a long time, maybe forever. I don't know the exact details. And, you know, didn't know if, Moshe didn't even know if he'd see the Rav again. Said goodbye, shook his hand, sent him on his way. It was a more of an intellectual, again, tremendously warm feelings they felt for each other. You know, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was, and I should just present the proper picture. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was from one of the greatest religious rabbinic dynasty possible. He married a woman who was slightly more, I want to call it liberal, but the Feinstein fancy was probably more liberal. They were well educated. They spoke many languages. They had money. They were wealthy. They had business. And I think that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik slightly veered off. I wouldn't call him liberal, but slightly moved to the left of the standard Soloveitchik family. He and his brother, Brisker Rav, had a wonderful relationship. They only spoke in learning. They only spoke in Sochi. They only spoke in Torah. But I think Rav Moshe Soloveitchik may have slightly moved off to the left a little bit. And, you know, certainly Moshe Soloveitchik, I think they had some of the profound influence that created the Rav's hashkafa and allowed him to develop, I guess, in more of an open-minded manner. In any event, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was slightly, maybe, again, this is the way some of the books present it, slightly disrespected by maybe more to the right. And in a certain sense, he felt he was going to train his son, the Rav, to become the greatest Talmud in the world. And almost not get revenge, chas v'shalom, but almost like stand strong in our line of the Mesorah, in our chain of Soloveitchik family. The Rav definitely lived up to those expectations. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik probably spent most of his time and energy educating the Rav more than writing Sfarim or educating communities. He really spent a lot of time with educating his son, the Rav. Not a mistake of Aaron Soloveitchik. I once heard the story. Tells the story that when they used to learn together, again, it was a tremendously loving relationship, focused around learning, but unique. Again, the Rav's father never kissed him. And the way Rav Soloveitchik tells the story is, the difference between me and my brother, referring to the Rav, is that every time my father didn't understand the sugi, he'd ask my father again, and even my father smacked him, forgetting the Torah, he'd keep on asking until he remembered the Torah. Because not me, I was afraid to get hit. Again, different on so many levels in the world we live in today. But in terms of the connection they had to each other and how it revolved around Torah, the Rav and his father is unbelievable. There's even a paper printed, the Chidush Agram, the Hagrid, which is the Rav produced Chidushim of the two of them. But in terms of the closeness, he definitely, you know, sort of Tabori, I think, once said, you know, the Rav's father never kissed me because we all wanted him. If I would have kissed him once, how much more pleasant would she have been for us? How much easier would it have been? It would have been much less harif. Rav was known as a tremendous, grown a tremendous thinker. You know, what else can I tell you about that? Two quick points about his brilliance. When the Rav was about 9 years old, his father, his grandfather Chaim, was the Gadol HaDor at the time, got his son's Beryl's notebook. At age 9 or age 11, some young age like that. And his grandfather starts reading the Torah that the Rav had produced at age 11. He was so impressed, he started running around the whole city of Brisk, showing everyone, look what my grandson's doing, look at his Chiddush Torah at such a young age. Literally, just unbelievably insightful things. I got the other point I was going to say, but I'll make a difference, I'll remind him. just to give you a proper picture, I think the Rav, someone once asked the Rav, could you give me a bracha, Rebbe? And the Rav responded, you're not an apple. Now, what are you, an apple? The Rav was not a Hasidic Rebbe. The Rav was a cold, literature thinker, maybe warm out of shir, but in his style of learning, there was nothing but truth, and a serious, significant emphasis on that. A high-level shir, academically challenging, rigorous in thought, and the Rav would walk in there, and he'd tell stories. If the Rav was prepared for shir would take an hour. If he wasn't prepared for shir, it would take 4 or 5 hours until he worked out the sugya. There was the people who sit in the Rav shir, they talk about, you know, an unparalleled experience. The attention was so thick, you can cut it. You know, totally different experience than what we have. Just a few, one or two quick last points. And in terms of his contributions, one of his major contributions, many contributions to the world, the start is his writings. Beyond that, his thought is probably, in terms of what gives the modern Orthodox world raglayim to stand on, legs to stand on, to give, you know, in terms of his thought, the modern Orthodox world has taken his thought, and he's essentially the gadol the modern Orthodox world looked to at the time. Beyond his thought and the revolutionary and creative open nature of the thought, critical analysis and balancing progressive thought with traditionalism, which I think he did a fantastic job. He was a real traditional brisker, on the other hand, an open-minded thinker as well. Beyond that, every single Rebbe in the modern Orthodox world, if not everyone, almost everyone, is a Talmud of the Rav or a Talmud of the Talmud of the Rav. Meaning, it's difficult to find Rebbeim in the world we come from who are not Talmidim of the Rav or Talmidim from Talmidim or maybe even Talmidim from Talmidim from Talmidim of the Rav. But it all goes back to him. It just shows the beginning of his profound influence he had in his Talmidim and how they impacted the modern Orthodox world. Beyond that, it's wrong not to mention his Hashkafa is very debated. There are people who think he's far to the left, there are people who think he's far to the right. Partially that's because he didn't talk Hashkafa and Shir. Partially it's because he was so broad and so thoughtful and so respected of a man. So profound of a man. It's like an elephant. You know, one person stands and touches something long and hard and white and thinks it's a tusk. And one person touches the trunk, one person touches the foot, one person touches the back. And they're all touching different parts because the elephant is so great they can't all see the different elements of it. I think the same is true with the Rav. The Rav was a tremendous thinker, a tremendous lamdan, a tremendously sophisticated individual. And part of the reason why there's so much debate, people think he's Haredi, people think he's totally left-wing, people think he's somewhere in the middle. I'm a big believer he's somewhere in the middle. I think he was a profound, sophisticated thinker. I don't think he was a tremendous left winger. I don't think he was a Haredi, but, well, usually left is probably more liberal and right is more conservative. It's debated, but nonetheless, the reason why there's so much debate is because there was so much to him. Meaning a person, he was so committed to the Brisker style of learning, you could think he's a close Haredi Brisker. His breadth of knowledge and his well-educated, you know, his education was so profound, you could think he's nothing but a modern philosopher. You could think his Tanakh is so rich, you could think he's almost like a Darshan or a Bible type of person. You could think there's just so many different dimensions to the personality. I believe, again, never met the Rav, but Maribayim and the overwhelming majority of people I know, believe it, at his roots were in Gemara, but his profoundness and his breadth was tremendously far-reaching. It's debated how much of a Zionist he was, you know, whether he said, how will I know Matzmut or not, some years yes and some years no, and that's debated as well. Yet he has a very strong Zionistic letter printed in one of his books about how much he appreciates it, how loves it. He wrote the Kol Dodi the Faith. It's difficult to imagine he wasn't Zionist at all. So I once heard Chai Nelson said the Rav of the 40s was different than the Rav of the 80s. Could be, I have no clue. There definitely were at least significantly strong Zionistic years, if not completely. Whether or not he went back and forth a little bit would not be shocking. He's a thinker, and thinkers tend to have different ideas at different points of time in their life. But he definitely was of the Zionistic camp. He didn't agree everything that the Mizrahi stood for, but he joined the Mizrahi over the Agud, and I think a lot of that was because of his appreciation and respect for the state of Israel. I don't think he was a messianistic, mishichistic Zionist. It's not, you know, like you find, you know, Cook and others. Pasha, that this is the Eschalta, the Geula, it's just a matter of time. The Rav definitely appreciated the fact that the state existed, and even if he probably on a religious level, if there's religious value in having a state, but probably did not view it as a
you know, as a definite step towards Mashiach. How did the world view him? Everyone in the world respected him as a Lama. Everyone in the world respected him as a Talmud Chacham. Everyone in the world respected him as someone who really knew how to learn as a Gadol Torah. His Hashkafas were more debated, partially because he was part of YU with his secular education involved, partially because of his own writings, partially because his wife didn't cover her hair for most of her life, for all of her life. I think that was also somewhat of an issue in terms of how people looked at him, if not mistaken. I once heard that he was offered a job in part of the Das, and they said to him, you have to do two things. Number one is pretend you didn't get a college education. Number two is tell you what to cover hair. He responded, one is biyadi, one is lo biyadi. I can only do one even if I wanted to. One is it under my control to do, and one is not, meaning I can tell you I could lie about my college education, but I can't make my wife cover hair, kind of thing. She didn't want to. Whether or not there was halakhic permissibility or not is debated. I think Rav Lichtenstein has an argument that the Rav had a stretch to make for his wife, and Rav Shaklin thinks, no, she doesn't keep halakha. What do you want to do? You have to divorce her. It's not a halakha. And his Talmid, and literally from the cuts to the cuts, and more some to the right, some to the left, some to the middle, some to the side, some to some other side, and they debate with the Rav, my Rebbe the Rav this way, my Rebbe the Rav that way. But they all do one thing. They all give a tremendous lamb, and they all give a tremendous influence on them. And, you know, again, in a quick 10, 15 minute presentation, 20 minutes, 25 minute presentation, if we kind of cover as best as we can. Quickly, yeah. He was a very significant and important person. Right, he was the major character in the Manuel Tetzel, the major rub in the Manuel Tetzel, he got the title. The truth is, in other communities in Israel, you say, the Harab, your friend's Rav Kook. In the Yeshivish world, it could be the Briska Rav, but the Manuel Tetzel is the Rav. He was the major, our personality in our community. All right, we'll stop here.